Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
My friends, I'm Vivian McPeak, and this is Hemp Present. If you have feedback or would like to suggest a guest or topic for Hemp Present, email me at hemppresent@gmail.com. Jack Lohman is a writer from Richmond, Virginia, who lives in the Western Isles of Scotland. He is the author of White Light, the elemental role of phosphorus in our cells, in our food, and in our world. And he's here to tell us about it. Welcome, Jack, to Cannabis Radio.
Thank you very much.
Your book, White Light, I just have to tell you, it's captivating. It opens an entire universe around this essential mineral of phosphorus. And I have to say, it's just fascinating and truly well written. What inspired you to focus on phosphorus as the central theme of your first book?
It feels like a bit of an esoteric topic, I think. But phosphorus is an element that's been on my mind for my entire life, from when I was a very small child gardening with my grandmother in Norfolk, Virginia, going into her tool shed and seeing these bags of different fertilizers. She would use dried blood for nitrogen and ground bones for phosphorus. I was fascinated by the ways in which these elements are tangible and real. And I loved the way that they turned into food. I loved learning about this. I loved being outside, being part of these cycles of the earth. And then as I went on through life, I learned about different ways phosphorus becomes a part of the world. Where I'm from in Virginia, we have problems with dead zones in the Chesapeake Bay, too many fertilizers, including phosphorus ones, running off from farm fields and causing issues in the water. We learned about this in school later on. Phosphorus mining came up when I was studying migration issues in different areas of the world. It was a topic that kept building and returning to me, and eventually it became this book.
How long did you research White Light, and what was the process like? What did you do to research it?
I started in 2018. I was working on just what became one chapter of this book, this chapter about the island of Nauru. And I originally conceived of it as a paper for school. That was it. It was a college paper. And I thought that as a student, not as a, you know, older, full-fledged journalist, I might be able to get into this island where access to journalists, advocates, any outsiders was restricted because of human rights violations that were happening there. And I did. I went to this island, which is located very far out in the Pacific Ocean, and I visited these refugee camps that had been built there in former phosphate mines. I spent a month there doing this work. And in the process of trying to contextualize that story, explain the mining that had happened, the reasons for the mining, the complexities of that, I began visiting all sorts of different phosphate mining sites all around the world, in England, in Florida. I visited refugee camps located on the border of Morocco, where some people were fleeing from places where phosphate had been mined. It became a really global story, and it involved a lot of long walks through nature with geologists, especially, who showed me how to read the ground and how to understand what had happened there and how that affects the rest of the world.
Wow, that's fascinating. You mentioned phosphorus mining. Phosphorus is mined from phosphate rock, a non-renewable resource for millennia. Animal migration has helped disperse phosphorus around our continents. It's reported that species extinctions and reduced animal populations and construction of fences and dams have reduced the animal transportation of phosphorus by more than 90%. From what you've studied, how critical is it to manage our supply and use of phosphorus mindfully? And how are we doing so far? Are there any concerns about humanity's supply running out, or is this an unlimited resource for us?
Well, for the vast majority of the history of human agriculture, this is a history of about 10,000 years, give or take. Humans found a way to recycle this element. Anytime you're using waste from animals or decomposing bodies or even the flood waters of certain rivers, you are recycling this phosphorus that otherwise might just run out into the ocean. This is the way humans farmed, even before we knew what phosphorus was, even before the 1600s when we first gave it a name. Since the early 1800s, however, this cycle has been ruptured. Rather than relying on these natural cycles that have played out over time, we've found a way to mine the rock instead of getting it from natural sources. And the result has been that we mine large amounts of phosphorus. We put them in our fields. It eventually makes its way into rivers. That makes their way eventually to the ocean, and we lose it. There's some talk nowadays about there being maybe a moment of peak phosphorus, of a time when we have the most available to us and we run out of what's being produced in the mines. And it's true on a local level, particularly in the United States, where Florida is a major producer. We're running out of phosphate rock there for sure. But the bigger issue that I talk about in the book is not a lack of phosphate rock to be mined, but it's the damage that's being done to fields and farms and to our bodies around the world as we rely on this particular method of extraction of phosphorus from the ground rather than some of these other techniques that were developed over thousands of years that actually provide more nutritious food and more plentiful gardens in the long term.
On that, along that line, you describe phosphorus in white light as both essential and potentially destructive. Can you talk about the environmental impact of phosphorus runoff and eutrophication or accumulation in bodies of water? Is how much of an issue is this?
Phosphorus is a fertilizer, which means we need it in order to grow. The reason it's a fertilizer is because phosphorus, in the form of phosphate, which is a compound of phosphorus and oxygen, phosphorus forms the basis of our cells. It forms the basis of our DNA, of ATP, which allows us to hold and transfer energy. It forms the membranes of our cells. So if you want to grow a plant, you need to have enough phosphorus available to make more cells. And so we add phosphorus to the ground. We make sure the ground has plentiful amounts. The thing about fertilizer is that if you have too much of it, it can become too much of a good thing. And this is what happens often in bodies of water. You have large amounts of phosphorus that run into, say, the Gulf of Mexico or the Chesapeake Bay, and there it feeds huge, wide amounts of algae that cover the surface of the water. They often block the light from penetrating down below and they decompose. As that algae decomposes, it is eaten by bacteria. This is the decomposition process. And during that process, the bacteria consume large amounts of oxygen, resulting in areas of oxygen depletion. There's not enough oxygen. And so the kinds of organisms that humans tend to preference, organisms like, for example, fish, can't live there. There's no oxygen available. The scientific term for this is eutrophication. It describes a body of water that's been affected in this way. The term that a lot of the public uses and that I use sometimes in the book is dead zone. It's an area where the life that we want to see in our bodies of water are has been extinguished.
And yeah, I mean, you know, tremendous ramifications from this. Is this something that's on the minds of environmentalists? I mean, is this an emerging issue? I mean, how serious of an issue is this?
People have been talking about this problem since the middle of the 20th century. This was a serious problem even in the 1960s. It was studied. It was determined at the time that inland eutrophication, the kind of, you know, these dead zones that form in lakes and ponds, tends to be created by phosphorus. It was determined that some of the other kinds that are out in the ocean are caused generally by nitrogen. And there's been work done. There have been regulations to try to limit phosphorus runoff. If you remember, a few decades ago, there was a movement to reduce phosphates from detergents because phosphates are useful in detergents to break up the clumps of dirt that form. This was a major contributor to eutrophication in the Great Lakes. This had become an issue. And today it's an increasingly problematic thing all across the world. You have lakes and ponds and bays and seas that are being affected by this. And the book, I talk about the Baltic Sea in particular, where the amount of phosphorus being deposited into the sea has increased more than tenfold over the last several decades. And it's resulted in enormous areas of that sea being unfit for a lot of the life that would ordinarily live there. It's really a major issue on every continent.
This show is primarily listened to by people in the cannabis culture. Many cannabis cultivators think of phosphorus as a key bloom booster, but the nutrient actually plays a very important and complex role in almost all plants, cannabis included. And in America, it's a major issue with food production. Can you touch on the critical role that phosphorus plays in the production of our food in general?
Every living being needs phosphorus. There's no known form of life that can exist without it. There are only six chemical elements that every form of life needs. And phosphorus is the rarest of these. It's the one that is the most concentrated in living beings. And it is, over the multi-billion year history of life on Earth, the limiting ingredient in the amount of life that can exist globally at any point in time. The way that works for food production is that when you grow food or any kind of plant in the ground, you need to keep replenishing the soil in some way, whether that's through some sort of mined or artificially derived fertilizer, or if it's through more natural means like manuring and composting. Our food system in the United States has become very, very industrialized in recent decades. This is something a lot of people talk about. And part of that industrializing process has been to split up farms that once might have been balanced. You might have long ago had a cycle, or today, and you know, many small farms that still exist, a cycle of animals producing waste that it's then used to fertilize the fields, which help to feed the animals. It's a virtuous cycle where the land is protected. When that was split through industrialized agriculture, you instead had large fields of plants which had no source of natural fertilizer. It had to be mined and brought in, and that became a bottleneck. You end up in the situation we're in today, where any kind of big corporate farming is going to be relying on annual inputs of these mined materials, including phosphate. And in the United States, at least, a huge portion of that comes from really just one big mine in Florida that's running out. So if you look at the food system in the United States or globally, there's a huge reliance on this input, which fluctuates wildly from year to year in terms of price. It's affected by natural disasters like hurricanes that come through Florida, and it exerts an enormous ecological toll on many areas of the world.
Wow. In your book, White Light, you weave just fascinating narratives about phosphorus, revealing its rich history with detailed stories of discovery and applications, and even geography and the politics surrounding it. Your book is as much a history lesson as a scientific analysis. What do you most hope the reader takes away from White Light?
I hope that people see themselves as a part of the ground. We think a lot about ecological problems in which humans, I think, are causing these issues. We're disrupting something. We are outside actors actively hurting the world. But this is a problem in which we can actually be a healthy part of the process. When we die, our bodies go to fertilize the ground. There are things we can do as we're alive that help to solve this problem, that make us actively a part of the solution to some of these crises in our world. And I hope one thing people take away from this book is to compost, if you aren't already. You know, compost your vegetable scraps. These are rich in phosphorus and rich in life. Compost leaves and branches, any kind of this good organic material that you have access to, it goes back into the soil. It makes a healthy plant. It helps you to connect to what's around you. On a personal level, it makes me very happy every day to take the bits and pieces that I've created throughout the day by eating and enjoying myself, take them outside, return them to the soil, and see over months how that turns back into the ground, and then see the plants that I can grow on that soil that I've slowly created, see the beautiful vegetables they can produce. It adds a lot of meaning, and I hope that more people do it.
I take a trip to our compost bin just about every day, and I especially cherish it here in springtime when we're planting. Jack, you know, phosphorus is in our bones, it's in our teeth, it's in our bloodstreams. Phosphorus is us, right?
It is us. It makes us who we are. It literally forms our identities. The structure of DNA is made of phosphate. And it's a little bit eerie when you think about it. You think about these sources phosphate comes from, whether it's a decomposing body or a mined rock. Those materials are making us. When we think about mining, often we're thinking about a material that's mined so that we can put it in a product, maybe put it in our phone, burn it as a fuel. Phosphate is something that's mined and makes us who we are. It goes into our body. And so when you and I are sitting here talking about, you know, a mine in Florida where all of this phosphate is pulled up, and somebody's listening to this, there might be phosphate from Florida in your bones right now. Chances are it's in your body somewhere. It's not just a theoretical concept, but it's inside of us and it makes us who we are.
Historically, phosphorus was first isolated through alchemical means and apparently discovered in 1969 by, or excuse me, 1669 by Hennig Brand, a German merchant, supposedly with 50 buckets of urine. What do you think the scientific journey of phosphorus tells us about the evolution of chemistry itself? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, at the time, the alchemists were searching for gold and the philosopher's stone as recently as, you know, in the 1600s when Brand found phosphorus. Modern chemistry did not exist. It came from these alchemists who were working in laboratories, building up the kinds of techniques that we think of today as chemistry. And they were motivated not just by knowledge, not really by general knowledge at all, but by the search for these certain priorities that people had. You know, they wanted, at the beginning, it was eternal life, eternal meaning. And eventually, it also became gold, this belief you could find gold. Urine is gold. They thought maybe if you processed urine in all these different ways, decanting it again and again, that you might end up with gold. What Brand found was something that glowed, and that was phosphorus. He had isolated pure phosphorus. And it's a kind of funny story because he's searching for gold. He finds phosphorus. He realizes here's a thing that can burn, it can ignite without ignition. That's pretty valuable. And that's how matches are created. The modern match that we think of, you strike the matchbook and it catches. That's made of phosphorus. That's phosphorus covered in paper. Pure phosphorus burns when exposed to the air. And so if you strike this against a hard surface, the paper that covers the phosphorus breaks, it exposes the phosphorus, it catches, it burns until it runs out. And in fact, what that's creating is phosphate. And so the history of chemistry goes back to the search for these, very individual things. And in fact, phosphorus is the first chemical element that is isolated in this way. We may have been aware of all kinds of elements, like, for example, iron for a very long time. But in a modern sense, when you think of isolating an element, understanding that this element is sitting on its own, phosphorus is the first. And it's named phosphorus after the Greek phrase bringer of light.
Wow. It's got a, definitely a deep origin story. Along that line, what role does phosphorus play in archaeology? What can it tell us about our lives and the livelihoods of our ancestors?
If you're looking at a particular site, say where a small town or village sat, you can learn about the agricultural practices and the spatial distribution of that particular point of civilization by seeing where the most phosphorus is. That might indicate that there was a dung pile. How do you get a dung pile? Well, maybe you keep animals, you keep the manure somewhere. There are lots of cases in which people have seen that maybe there's no high concentration of phosphorus inside the settlement, which would indicate that there was farming happening with these fertilizers being applied even hundreds or thousands of years ago. It's kind of like this idea that, you can look in the trash and see from ancient trash what people's lives were really like, the way you could do in modern trash receptacles as well. You could go to a landfill and learn a lot about society. In this case, you're learning a lot about how people lived by seeing how they dealt with waste and how they allowed phosphorus to cycle through their daily lives.
So the presence of phosphorus in the soil is really a forensic tool for archaeologists. That's really fascinating. Of everything that you found in your research, when you were working on white light, what's the most surprising thing that you learned about phosphorus that you'd like to share? Oh, we still have a few minutes.
Well, at the very beginning, I saw it as a story of a resource that's running out. To one of your earlier questions today, I think it's easy to look at the mining that's happening and to think, well, we need these mines. It's really a priority to be able to mine phosphorus and distribute it in this way. But through the process of researching this book, it became very clear to me that this process of mining is only necessary because of the industrial system that's built up around it and only works economically because of subsidies. There's a lot of talk of more efficient ways of farming that a big industrial scale system produces food more efficiently. And it's really not true because those kinds of systems of mining and producing fertilizers and building a farm in this way only works because the government chooses to subsidize that. Far less subsidy exists for, say, composting and manuring. And when you ask why we do one rather than the other, why is it such a preference to mine phosphate rock? The answer is that it's too expensive to carry this, very wet, heavy waste different places to move it around. It, of course, only needs to be moved far because we've chosen as a society, or rather the, wealthy overlords of our society have chosen for us to have a food system that, enriches corporations at the expense of poor people. And the only reason even that works is because of billions and billions of dollars of money that goes directly to this kind of place, to this mining regime. In some countries, particularly, you look at enormous multi-billion, $20 billion annual subsidies for phosphate fertilizer in particular in China and India. These are places where the price of phosphate and nitrate fertilizers are capped. These are mined, artificially produced, industrially produced fertilizers are capped, and the government pays the difference, which reaches as high as 90% of the price. If you were to remove these subsidies that prop up industrial agriculture, you would find that this whole system of extractive mining, rather than the cycling that smaller farmers use, really falls apart. And so when we talk about phosphate mines, and in this book, there's a lot of discussion about the damages of those mines and the way it damages the land, you often hear an industry response that says, well, there's going to be a famine. If we don't have this, it's not going to work. But it doesn't work already. And I think through the process of writing this book, it became really, really clear to me what a dishonest position it is to say that mined phosphate fertilizer and industrial agriculture as a whole feeds the world.
Wow. Jack, we have about a little over a minute left. Quickly, do you have any other projects planned? How can people access your book? And what final thoughts would you like to leave us with?
Well, this book is available through, I think, all the major booksellers. You can go on bookshop.org, on Amazon, anywhere. I hope you do. I hope it's this is, a subject that you see the way I see it, which is, and this element has its tentacles in all different parts of our lives and our world. Right now, I'm working on a history of a small town in Mongolia, which is where the very first official Dalai Lama came several hundred years ago to be named the Dalai Lama.
Jack Lohman, author of White Light, a just truly thoughtful and expansive work from Pantheon Books. Thank you so much for being on Hemp Present. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. The Hemp Present intro music is 7 Mile Beach by Joanne Rand, and the outro music is Take Back the Plant by Stickerbush. See you next time, folks. Stay strong.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ziprecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ziprecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ziprecruiter.com/zip.